Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, listeners. Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars. We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
She's a chick's the goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us
Thank
your
you.
Reviews,
Please.
Friends.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and Stitcher.
Today's guest is one of the most accomplished press agents in the history of Broadway, and if you read her brilliant book, Backstage Pass to Broadway, True Tales from a Theater Press Agent, you will see that sometimes what happens offstage is more dramatic than what happens on stage.
It's true. Her remarkable career has included such highlights as trying to tame Zira Mostel, dancing with Bob Fosse, defending Mary Martin, and defeating David Merrick.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as Raul Julia, George C. Scott, Ronald Reagan, and to be friends with the Fonz, here is Susan L. Shulman.
Hi.
Welcome. Hi. Susan. My head turned like 8 times with those names.
Jeez, you knew
Mine
everybody.
Too. Gosh. So for I must be old. God.
Wise.
Wise and legendary.
Vintage.
We like to say we're legendarily wise.
I'm seasoned.
Now, for our listeners who aren't familiar with what your job does, what exactly is the definition? How would you define?
Which I'm sure you've been asked over and over again.
Have. Yes. And the truth is, nobody knows what a press agent does. That's the funny thing. I always laugh and say it's smiling and nodding at an opening night or to critics. It's, hi, thanks for coming, enjoy the show. Hi, thanks for coming, enjoy the show. Hi, thanks for coming, enjoy the show. But the truth is, what we do is we create the right expectations, both for an audience and for critics. Mm-hmm. So if you're handling an Ibsen play, you don't really want to say it's a laugh riot. You know, it's not a knee slapper.
Right.
It's a drama. And so you really have to, the press agent's job is to create the right expectation. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
You want an example?
Yes, please.
Okay, you mentioned the adorable Bob Fosse,
who
I did, in fact, dance with, not on stage, but I did dance with Bob Fosse.
I love that.
Bob Fosse was doing a show called Dancin'.
Yes.
Wonderful show. He always took his shows to Boston before they came to New York. That was his tryout town. He respected the critics there. He respected the audiences there. He felt they gave him real feedback on what he put on the stage, and he appreciated that. When the show started in Boston, he talked about how it was a review. It was a bunch of dance numbers he wanted to put on stage before he got too old, is the way he put it. It was never a book musical. It wasn't like Sweet Charity or Chicago. It didn't have a book.
Right.
It wasn't supposed to have a book. It never intended to have a book. And the show opened in Boston, and it got okay reviews, but they were unhappy because there was no book. And they kept saying, there's no book, there's no thread, there's no story. Well, there wasn't supposed to be. But somehow we hadn't communicated that. We hadn't managed to put that out there in an interesting enough way that both the audiences and the critics had the right expectation.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was like we gave them apples instead of oranges, and they were expecting
like, hey,
oranges.
Where's my oranges?
That's right. No. And no matter how good the apples were, they didn't want the apples. They wanted the oranges. So before it opened in New York, which was about, I would say, 90-95% the same show, because he always tinkered and fiddled and fixed things, and he could do it better than anybody.
Yeah.
We really sat down with him, and we said, listen, you're going to do a Sunday Times, what's called a pre-opening reader, a Sunday Times feature in the Arts and Leisure section. And it's very important you talk about how there's no theme, there's no story, there's no thread. It's just a bunch of dance numbers on stage. And he did. And the Sunday Times piece came out. And, of course, it's read by theater critics as well as by the audience, general public. And the show opened, as I say, pretty much the same show that had opened in Boston with Tinkering. And the critics said, it's fabulous. There's no thread. There's no storyline. There's no book. Because this time their expectations were met.
Right. They're like, we love oranges.
It was just, it was a perfect example of having the right expectations and then meeting them. Now, of course, he could meet them better than anybody. So, you know, it was about Vasey. But even so, the fact is that we hadn't quite gotten it right in Boston. And by New York, we did. And so that's what I mean about creating the right expectations.
Incredible. And so as a press agent, you have relationships not only with producers and directors of the Broadway shows, but you have relationships with papers and with media outlets.
Of course,
and
with all of,
I never even thought that. Yes, of course you know every single reviewer you know, of the New York Times.
Well, I mean, you know, I always think we're all in this together.
Yes.
Because we all see everything and we all, you know, but I'm not sure critics think that. Mm-hmm. But I think that because I think it, at the end of the day, we're all in this business because we love it.
Right.
And we're not in it to make money because we could all make a lot more money doing something else.
Sure. Yes.
And that's true of critics as well and journalists. So I think that we're all in it because deep in our hearts, you know, we love the theater.
Right.
And so when I say we're all in this together, that's kind of what I mean. Of course, sometimes it's not, we're not on the same side. You know, it's like anything.
What do you think makes a good theater critic?
Wow, that's a good question. First of all, they have to love the theater.
Yeah.
And I'm always surprised when somebody is hired to be a theater critic who brings no theater experience to the table. It's like shocking to me that happens, and it does. Obviously, they have to be a good journalist, but I think they really need to love it. And I'm not sure everybody does anymore. Of course, nowadays they're bumping off theater critics. You know, so many of the major newspapers have cut their theater critic, which is shocking and horrible.
Sad. Very sad.
Yeah, it is.
Did you always know that you were going to get involved in a theatrical career?
I grew up in New York. Mm-hmm. I was a theater kid. I used to hang out at stage doors. And I really didn't want anybody's autograph. I wanted to tell them how much they had impacted my life. So
that's awesome.
I know.
Where were some of your first stage doors that you would go to?
Oh, my God.
Everybody.
I mean, Man of La Mancha. You know, and sometimes people would befriend me and they would be nice to me and they would say, do you want to see the set or you want to come backstage? But I was a little kid. I mean, I was like in high school. And I really didn't want I didn't care if I got their autograph. I just wanted to sort of say, that was so moving to me. You know, you changed my life or whatever. Or I'd write them letters. That's how I started with Mary Martin. I wrote her a fan letter, and she answered. And so I wrote her another letter, and she answered. And I wrote another letter, and she answered. And this went on until she died. And I didn't know till years later that there were like a million people that did that. I thought I was the only one who wrote fan letters. What did I know?
Back when people really did
write
letters.
Answered, you know. Or I'd say, I'm coming to see your show on such and such date. Could I meet you? This was before people had lined up outside stage doors. You know, they didn't do any of that stuff, barricades and stuff. It wasn't like, even for big, big stars, it wasn't, except for, you know, like Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, but not for most Broadway stars. And so I would, sometimes they would leave my name at the stage door after a matinee. And I would, you know, get invited back. And it was just because I wrote a nice letter. I didn't want anything. I didn't, you know, I had no axe to grind or anything.
Right.
I wasn't like, you know, I wasn't going to sell it or anything.
Yeah,
I was just a little fan.
The love of theater,
And I guess they knew that. You know, I guess it was communicated in some way because it was genuine. It wasn't, I had no agenda. And so I loved it. I went to shows all the time. But I didn't see any way that I could ever be part of it. I couldn't imagine.
You never saw yourself as a performer. You never thought, maybe
I used to do, you know, shows and summer stock and college and stuff. But I think in my heart I knew I wasn't good enough. I knew I wasn't tough enough.
Wow.
I was always sort of a big fish in a little pond. You know, I'd get discovered once a year and some agent would say, oh, here's my card, and then nothing would happen. You know, but I think I always knew I wasn't tough enough. But I couldn't imagine how I could be part of it. I came from a family of educators and entrepreneurs. Nobody ever was in the theater. Nobody had anything to do with the theater. You know,
but they supported the arts,
probably. Oh, they took me to the theater.
Yeah.
I mean, from the time I was five, my parents took me to Broadway shows.
Wow.
So I loved it, and they loved it too. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a career. You know, it wasn't what you grew up and you became, you know, a teacher or a doctor or something else. Right. You know, you didn't become a press agent. That wasn't one of the lists on the list. But I couldn't imagine how I could be part of it. I just was a fan and I loved it, and I read everything and I knew everything and I knew all the players. I knew the names of everybody, you know. And what happened was, when I was in college, I, by instinct, not because I even knew what I was doing, I was kind of the one beating the bushes for plays. I was always the one coming up with schemes for how to, it turns out, publicize it. But I didn't really know that's what I was doing. Wow. I didn't have any, you know.
Was this undergrad at NYU?
At NYU. Yeah. But even in the summers, I would do it. But what happened was, when I graduated from college, Manny Eisenberg, who was a very big producer at the time and still is, mm-hmm. had been an NYU graduate many years prior to my graduating from college. And Manny was sort of the great star of NYU. And so everybody would go to Manny for a job, everybody who wanted to be in the theater. Now, Manny was the only person I had, and I didn't know Manny. I mean, he would come to shows, and I sort of vaguely knew him, but I didn't know him. And he was, you know, a hot producer at the time, hot young producer. And I went and interviewed with somebody in Manny's office, and they kept saying, call us in 2 weeks, call us in 2 weeks, call us in 2 weeks, call us in 2 weeks. And this went on for quite a long time. And at the same time this was going on, I had interviewed for a job at Lincoln Center, Inc., and Lincoln Center had just been built, and so Lincoln Center was quite the hot place to be. And I was so naive and so dumb that I really didn't even know what the job was. I mean, it was a lackey job. I couldn't type or anything useful, so it was like I wasn't the secretary or anything. It was much lower down than that. And so on one hand, the theater job, the Manny Eisenberg glamour showbizy job, they kept saying, call us in 2 weeks. On the other hand, Lincoln Center kept offering me jobs, and I kept saying no. And finally, my mother said, you think maybe it's – and this is now maybe September, October, after I graduated in, you know, May.
And what was your degree in, sorry to interrupt?
Theater in English.
It was theater in English.
Which turns out, of course, how much more perfect could that have been?
But, but you didn't know. But who knew? Even then, you didn't know where your career was going.
Didn't know that was a job.
Okay.
So I keep turning down Lincoln Center, Inc., and I keep holding out for this you know, job in Never Never Land with Manny. And finally, my mother said to me, very practically, you think maybe it's time you got a real job, you know, instead of waiting for this. And so I thought, oh, all right, I'll take the job at Lincoln Center because the other, you know, until the other one comes through.
Right.
And so I did. And it turned out, now this is where life surprises you. Now, I was a little kid. I didn't know how to do anything. I couldn't type. I couldn't do anything useful. I was bright, and I was capable, and I was, you know, I had good instincts, but I didn't have any skills that anybody would actually pay me to do, you know. It turned out that the job, which I didn't even know what department it was in, this shows you how dumb I was to be the assistant to the press director for Lincoln Center, Inc. Really.
Wow.
Now, everybody talks about the fork in the road.
Yeah.
If the job in Manny's office, and by the way, eventually I worked for Manny as his press agent. So, you know, life comes full circle. But if that was, without knowing it, a fork in the road, where if the job with Manny's office had come through, I probably would have eventually become a general manager or a company manager.
Right. Oh.
For which I am so not suited. This, because to be a company manager, it's all about payrolls and contracts,
yep,
and
numbers
and, yeah, and all the things that really I could care less about.
Yeah.
And the fork in the road led me to Jack Frizzell, who was the press director for Lincoln Center, Inc., who was the world's most lovely human being. Wow. The best first boss anybody could have ever had, because he was so kind and gentle and funny and helpful and supportive. And I was just in the right place at the right time. Nothing to do with my, you know, nothing to do really with me.
Yeah.
I just was in the right place at the right time.
You just took the job, yeah.
And so worked for Jack for a year and a half. Loved him. Loved working at Lincoln Center. Lincoln Center was very much, you know, the hot, buzzy place. And at the end of a year and a half, by this time I was sort of the little golden girl. Everybody liked me, and I did a good job, and I learned, and I was bright. They had a cutback. And because I was the, you know, last one in, I was the first one out.
Sure. Totally.
And I'd never been fired from anything. I'd never worked anywhere.
Right. So it was your first job.
Where, fired. Yeah. Where had I been fired from? Girl Scout camp, where I was a counselor. And so, it's true. Funny. But because I was the first one that they had to let go, and they felt bad. I
of
mean,
course.
It wasn't like
sure.
they wanted to fire me, but they had a cutback. Because they all felt guilty, and because I was the first one, they all helped me. And I wound up working for a press agent named Frank Goodman, who was the press agent for the theater arm. At the time, it was called the Music Theater of Lincoln Center, and it was run by Richard Rogers. Thank
oh,
you
yes,
very much.
Of course. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
they did all these fabulous revivals and stuff. And Frank Goodman was their press agent. And because, as I say, because I was the first one to get fired, they made calls for me and they helped me. I always said if I was the third one fired, nobody would have lifted a finger. But because I was the first one, they were nice to me.
Yeah.
And so I wound up going from Lincoln Center into working for Frank Goodman, who was a theater press agent. And that was sort of my foot in the door.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long, convoluted answer to a very simple question.
It's funny how so many legends that we've talked to, a lot of the reasons why they got where they are is because some serendipitous moment happened and it wasn't planned or anything. It just,
well,
that
you know,
fork in the road moment,
it's
fascinating.
You know, the thing that I always say is that it was, I mean, this part of it was totally luck. I was totally in the right place at the right time. But the other side of it is that I had exactly the qualifications
exactly.
that somebody needed. Yeah. I had this theater and English background where I could write and I got it. I understood what it was about. And so I was really very well suited for this job, although I'm not sure they really knew it.
Mm.
You know, it was a combination of things. I'll tell you another one of those accident things that happened. There is a wonderful store called the Drama Bookshop.
Of course, yes. Where and your book is.
Where my book is. I love the Drama Bookshop. I always have loved the Drama Bookshop.
Yeah.
Years ago, Drama Bookshop was on 52nd Street. This was several incarnations ago. And when I was in college, I guess, I used to go up to the Drama Bookshop and, you know, pick up plays that we were doing or whatever, for readings or whatever we were doing, like everybody else.
Yeah.
And now this is now after college. And after Lincoln Center and Frank Goodman, maybe I was around that time. So maybe I was a year or so out of 2 years out of college. And I'm going up to the Drama Bookshop, and the door opens on the wrong floor. I mean, on another floor.
Yeah.
And it opens, and I see a sign that says Bill Dahl and Company. Now, because I was a theater kid, and because I used to read the back of the book and programs, I knew that Bill Dahl was a theater press agent. It was a big theater press agent. So the elevator door opens. I see the sign. I get off the elevator. I go into the Bill Dahl office. I say, could I leave a resume? Now, why did I have a resume with me?
Like
I have no idea. I had a resume with me. And they say, sure. And they look at me. They say, can you wait a minute? I say, sure. They look at my resume. They say, can you wait a few minutes? I say, sure, because what am I doing? I'm going to the Drama Bookshop to browse, right? I wait a few minutes. They say, Bill would like to talk to you. They take me to the back. I meet Bill Dahl, who is this old-style Southern gentleman who is just Mr. Showbiz.
Yeah.
And we chat, and he says, can you start on Monday?
Wow.
And it turned out that somebody had left, like, you know, a minute before I got off the elevator. Mm-hmm. They were looking for somebody to do to pitch radio and TV. I had just been doing that at Frank Goodman's office. And the reason I wasn't at Frank Goodman's office was because a show had closed. And in those, in all press offices, the number of shows dictates the number of people that work there. It's a union thing. And so I walk in off the street, literally off the street, literally off the elevator, and get a job with one of the biggest press agents in New York.
I mean,
and wind up handling Applause.
Wow.
Wow. And now, was Applause your first Broadway show?
My first show from scratch. I'd worked on other shows in the other offices that I'd worked for other press agents in between.
And what a show to work on from scratch.
But talk about being in the right place at the right time.
I know.
And luck, because truly, I didn't know Bill Dahl was in that office, in that building.
Yeah.
The elevator opened, and in fact, when I launched my book, I did an event at the Drama Bookshop, and I said to Alan, who's the owner, I said, you know, my career is thanks to the Drama Bookshop. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, I'm going to tell a story at this thing, because really, it's true, you know? And I mean, it's that the dopiest thing?
That is
how
wild.
It's completely true.
And if, you mentioned this in the book, so would you be so kind as to tell our listeners how old you were when you got your first Broadway musical under your belt?
I was 23.
I'm sorry.
Applause.
I just dropped the microphone for a second there.
But you know something? That is so nuts that that happened, the way it happened and what happened. And I'll tell you what happened. But it was unheard of, and it shouldn't have happened, but it did. What happened was everybody in the Bill Dahl office was working on Applause when it started.
It had Lauren Bacall. I mean, it's this big,
Lauren Bacall,
big,
Len
big,
Carey,
epic
big,
show.
Big
yeah.
epic show. It was written by Comden and Green for Betty.
Yeah.
It, Adams and Strauss, directed by Ron Field. It was created as a vehicle for her.
Yeah.
And she was. It was her first musical. She had done two comedies on Broadway, and this was after years of being the, you know, kind of the queen of Hollywood. And then,
yeah.
and then Bogey died, and she was kind of dumped by Hollywood, and she decided to come back to New York, where she grew up and returned to the theater and go to yeah. the theater, which is what she had always wanted to do initially before she became a movie star. Anyway, so Applause was being created by her friends for her as a vehicle to showcase her. So it was built around her persona. Everything about it was created in a way to showcase Betty's what Betty brought
yeah.
to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the first one to tell you that she wasn't a great singer, she wasn't a great dancer. But it was a time when vehicles were created to showcase
yeah.
a big star and at what they did best.
Yeah.
And so the reason that a show like Applause doesn't get revived very often and doesn't really work anymore, first of all, it's very dated, but second of all, because it was so specifically created around her persona
yeah.
that it sort of doesn't work when it's somebody else.
Like Barbra Streisand and Funny Girl almost.
Exactly.
You know, very similar.
You need,
it's
oh, you
so
need that
together.
Somebody that's so distinctive
yeah.
and so uniquely theatrical.
Totally.
And it sort of doesn't work.
There's only one Bacall in this lifetime, you
and,
know?
and it's been done with very good other people, but it just sucks. It's just...
Totally.
Anyway, so what happened was Bacall was tough. She'd had a tough life. She was a tough cookie. And she didn't suffer fools
right.
very well.
We've heard.
And she was... she desperately wanted to do well in Applause. I mean,
yeah.
it was so important to her. She wasn't, believe me, she wasn't phoning it in. She took singing lesson every day before rehearsals. She worked with a dance instructor on the side. She really was serious. I mean, she was working it. And, you know, wasn't selfish at all about the actors. She wanted everybody to have their, you know, to shine. She was very gracious to everybody. She was very kind to everybody. And she was the den mother. She was the mommy in the company. Somebody got hurt, they were brought to her dressing room. You know, she was the mom. Anyway, so during rehearsals, everybody was in the press office was kind of afraid of her because she was a tough cookie. And she let you know what she wanted and what she didn't want, and she was very definite about it. For some reason, I could see that underneath this sort of tough exterior that she was kind of a big softy. And I don't know why I could see it. Maybe because I was a young kid, she didn't feel she had to put it on with me. I don't know. But
yeah,
for whatever reason...
A woman and...
Well, but I was a kid. I mean, I was really a young kid.
Yeah.
Anyway, because everybody was kind of afraid of her a little bit, and for good reason, she was, you know, she could be tough. She would ask if something was done, and they would say yes. And then she'd find out it wasn't done, and she'd kill them.
Right.
And I, with the innocence of youth, would say, she'd ask me if something, and I'd say, I don't know, I'll find out, and if it isn't done, I'll take care of it. And I wasn't being manipulative. I mean, I didn't know any better.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
I was just,
absolutely.
I was just
good
honest.
Answer.
Well, I was honest. I mean, I was just, I was a straightforward kid, and I really wanted to do good, and I was trying hard. And wasn't manipulative. Somebody years later said to me, how did you manipulate that? I said, I could barely get my clothes on right, you know, right side out. I couldn't.
Totally.
I'm not sure I could have done it now, but I certainly couldn't have done it then. Anyway, so one day I'm called into Bill's office, and he says, we just had a meeting with Larry Cash and Joe Kipnis, the producers of Applause, and Betty has told them, this is so stupid, that the only person she will deal with, that she will speak to in
no
the
way.
Bill Dahl office is you.
Good Susan.
So here I am. It was nuts. Really, it was nuts. So here I am, 23. I'm
right.
not even in the union yet. I'm still apprenticing to ATPAM, which is the press agents union.
Oh, thank you. I was going to ask what
yes.
the union
and
is.
I'm still apprenticing. I don't even have my weeks to get in the union. And I am now informed that I am the sole person in the Bill Dahl office that Betty Bacall will speak to.
My God.
nuts. It's really
it's
nuts.
It's incredible.
It was. It was nuts. Nowadays, nobody would let this happen. It was crazy. But it did happen.
But she was, you know, Len Cario told us how he, you know, she will approved his casting.
Absolutely.
You know, like she was there for the callback.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. She was absolutely on top of her game. She was calling the shots. And so for her to go to Kipnis and Cash and say this, it was nuts. So there I was. And the thing that's so funny is I look back now and I think, well, were they crazy? I mean, like, what the hell did I know? You know, I mean, I had good instincts and I certainly try. I mean, yeah. I worked night and day. But, I mean, they let it happen, you know. And they did let it happen because they...
It's a good account.
They
you
didn't,
know,
they didn't. So in order to keep the account... Suddenly, I was a little more valuable. I didn't get a penny more, I'll tell you that.
No, of course not.
In fact, I'll tell you something mean. When opening night came, and of course, I was so thrilled. I mean, I was like over the moon. You know, here I am handling this. I mean, I was so
sure.
I was in such heaven. And I was so, you know, kind of in love with everything about it. You know, I was so enamored with her. I couldn't believe that I was, you know, I could walk into the palace stage door and someone would say, "Hi, Susan."
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't
yeah.
believe it. It was like, how, what?
Yeah.
Opening night, I wasn't given seats, and I didn't even think about it. I thought, well, of course I have to stand in the back. And later I realized that everybody in the Bill Dole office was given press had given themselves press
of course
seats
they
except
did.
Me, you know. But I didn't care because I was so happy to be there. I couldn't believe it. You
that's
know, it was
so wonderful.
It was like magic. But that's how it happened. And
I'm just amazed by that.
What were
so was I.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Well, it's obviously panned out quite beautifully. What were some of your responsibilities for publicizing that show? I mean, you've got this great big star doing her first musical, so I'm assuming that's mm-hmm. an easy in. But what else did you have to do?
Well, interestingly, because Bacall was such a big star, she really didn't want to, and she'd of course done everything by this time. She, you know, she'd been a huge Hollywood
yes.
star and all this. She really didn't want to do a lot of publicity. And so it was my job to figure out how to sort of deflect things that, you know, journalists say wanted Bacall. And I'd say, well, unfortunately, Betty is, you know, on vocal rest
right.
or whatever,
it's
you know.
Rigorous schedule, yeah.
Yeah. But how about Penny Fuller? How about Bonnie Franklin? How about Len Cario? How about Leroy Reams?
Right.
You know, how about Brandon Maggart? And so it was a matter of finding all the other things that I had to sell and getting them coverage. And it's also things like designing the front of house, picking the photos that go out in front of the theater. Nowadays it's done more by the advertising agency, but in those days it was done by the press agent.
Wow.
So, you know, you really had to balance, you know, people's billing against people's importance to the show,
yeah.
to the relationship with the star, you know, in visually in terms
of... And that's
of,
you making that decision.
That was me making those decisions, yes. And also it was, you know, there were thousands of interview requests for because it was a huge hit. And then,
yeah.
of course, it won the Tony for Best Musical, and so it became an even bigger hit. But it was because of Bacall initially. And also it was Comden and Green. It was Adams and Strauss who had done Bye Bye Birdie.
Right.
It was everything about the show. There were so many hooks for things. And there were lots of opportunities for some of the gypsies, the chorus dancers in
yeah.
the show, where I would do hometown stories, for instance. And... Because it was a very happy company, because it was she set the tone, and she, and the star of the show very often does set the tone of a company, and she set the tone on that one because she was so happy. She was so it was such a happy time in her life. And the funny thing was that I'm somebody who always introduces myself when I meet somebody. I never say hi. I always say, hi, I'm Susan Shulman, because I hate that momentary blank look in people's eyes where they're trying to figure out who you are. Totally. And I hate that. And I wish everybody did that, because it would make life a lot easier, because none of us are that, you know.
Yeah.
And so for the rest of her life, whenever I'd bump into Betty, and this went on for years, I'd say, hi, Betty, Susan Shulman. And she always would say, I know who the hell you are. And, and then she would give me a hug. Always, always gracious. Never a time when she wasn't gracious to me. And I believe it was because, and she would always say the same thing. That was, it was like our act, yes. You know, hi, Susan Shulman. And she'd say, I know who the hell you are, and give me a kiss. And, but I think it's because I was part of a very happy time in her life.
Yeah.
And so in her mind, I was identified with that. Right. And I was very protective of her, and I cared, and she knew I cared. I mean, exactly, I adored her. She was wonderful to me. And I was, as I say, I was a little kid. So I always thought, if she had ever, you know, come at me with, you know, that other side of her personality, I'm sure I would have crumbled, because I didn't have any defenses. I didn't have a way to cope with that. And I think she knew that. I think she must have instinctively thought that, you know, I can't do this with her, because she will crumble, and then I'll have to deal with that. You know?
Right. Do you always feel protective with the actors in the show?
Always. Unless they're terrible people.
Yeah.
And there's only been a few. Mostly I adore actors.
Yeah. I was going to say this. You don't have to mention any names, but how do you continue to publicize a show when you really just do not enjoy the presence of either the actors or the creative team? How do you get around that?
My job is to figure out what I have to sell and who to sell it to. We're inclusive now. It wasn't when I first started. So it was an apprenticeship. I mean, you worked for low wages, and you worked for people, and then when you got in the union, then you became an associate, and you worked on shows as their associate. And if a show closed, then you very often had to find another job at another press office, because the number of associates was dictated by the number of contracts that the senior press agent handled. And so I worked for lots of press agents, and I learned my craft, and I loved it. I was a very good associate. I was very supportive. I loved working for other people. And eventually reached a point where it was time to go out on my own and open my own office. And so in 1978, I was working for Merle Dubusky, who was the top Broadway press agent, and had worked for Merle for almost 5 years. Wow. And, you know, it was great. And he couldn't have been more supportive that it was time for me to, you know, leave the nest and open my own office. And I did. And then I had my own press office in the Paramount building for a while. And then in 1985, CBS made me the offer you can't refuse.
Yeah.
And at that time, theater was going through a bad patch, and there were fewer shows getting up, and there was not very much money around. And so you'd be hired for a show, and then it wouldn't get on because they couldn't raise the money. And it was a tough time.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is a sign. CBS wants me. And CBS actually created a job for me. It was unheard of. It was crazy. It was also like, you know, getting off the elevator at the wrong floor.
Yeah.
And
I wasn't. I had my own
office. I was hills and valleys, but it was fine. And I had sort of one big show a year and lots of smaller shows. So it was okay. And I thought, oh, this is maybe what I'm meant to do. Hmm. And so I closed my office, and I went to CBS, and it was a job created for me. It was really something.
Wow.
And from day one, I knew it was a mistake. It was terrible.
Okay. You were no longer working in the theater industry.
Well, I had nothing to do with the theater, but I had never worked in a big corporate environment before. I didn't know what hit me. I was a director, which was very high level at CBS, which was meant I was managing a department.
Right. What was the job they created for you?
Director of press information, and I handled all the publicity for all the miniseries, which in mid 80s was a big deal at CBS. And it was all these, you know, multi-night events, sins with sins.
Wow.
Yeah, we had a lot of really big shows with big talent. And it was Sins starring Joan Collins.
Oh.
Yes, I think I can sell that, I said.
Joan Collins. Nice.
Joan Collins in Sins. Anyway, you know, it was...
Of course she was.
Yeah, right.
I mean, like, of course that was the title.
I think I can get some coverage on that, yeah. But the truth was, I wasn't very well suited for the job, and they were right to hire me because I understood how to do it, but I didn't much like it, because the truth was, when you talk about being involved with the creative process in television, it's a product.
Right.
You're presented with a product. It's done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, you've got these five stars to publicize. You've got this amount of time. You've got, it was very cut and dried.
There was no stage door Johnny's knowing your name,
no.
You know, like that kind
no.
of personal.
And,
yeah.
And the fact was that I was managing 25 people who were doing exactly what I loved to do, and which, in fact, I was probably better at than they were. And instead, I was doing goals and strategies and fourth quarter marketing reviews. And so it was like, oh, this isn't fun at all.
Yeah.
And I spent 6 years in television land. I was at CBS, and then I was the head of PR at A&E for 4 years.
Oh, my goodness.
First, I was at USA Network and then at A&E. And so I spent 6 years in all in television land. Didn't much like it. And at the end of it, I thought, why am I doing this? I could be back doing something I love.
Mm-hmm.
And I left. I gave notice. Nobody ever gave notice in those days in television. In my department at CBS had all been there 20 years. I mean, they couldn't believe anybody left. And I went back to the theater and worked as somebody's associate. And I, the first day I had to cover something. It was at City of Angels.
Oh yeah.
And I went over to I walked in the stage door, and I had this absolutely overwhelming sense of being home.
Oh.
I'll never forget it, because it was almost shocking to me that it was so strong. It was that, you know, people talk about an aha moment.
Yeah.
To this day I can remember the feeling of walking through the stage door and thinking, I know exactly how to do this job. I know exactly what I need to do. I know exactly who I need to talk to. I know exactly how to do this. And the whole time I was in television land, I never felt that. I always felt, you know, I'm like hanging on by my toenails a little bit. You know, I mean, I can do it, but I don't know what I'm doing. And it was that overwhelming sense of being where I should be.
Right.
It was interesting.
Oh, wow. And confirmed it. I mean, it
was,
thank goodness.
It was such a, it was, I mean, to this day, I can remember that feeling and thinking, ah, this is what I am supposed to be doing. And I worked for this, I worked for this press agent for maybe 6 months. And then I reopened my own office back in the Paramount.
Yeah.
Bigger and better.
Yep.
I love it.
How do you deal with, a star or a big actor who is publicity shy, who might be a little bit more reclusive off stage?
Oh, yeah. I can imagine that happens from time to time.
It does happen, and it's a challenge. I mean, you have to figure it out. It's like, well, what else do I have to sell? Or maybe it's a matter of channeling that reluctance in a way that that person needs. For instance, Vanessa Redgrave did a show at the Circle in the Square. And I kept going to her and saying, will you talk to the New York Times? And she'd say no. And I'd say, and then I'd come back and I'd say, what about talking to the Associated Press? And she'd say no. And then I'd come back and I'd say, what about talking? And no. It was always no. And finally, out of sort of desperation, because she was very political. She was very involved. You know, she had done a very famous anti-Israel speech when she won an Oscar, and so there was a lot. She was very politically involved and very a lot of anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian stuff. And finally, out of desperation, I said, "Have you been told by either your government or our government that you can't talk to the media?" And she just said yes.
Wow.
And I never knew whether that was the U.S. government or whether it was the British government or whether it was a condition of her work permit. I never knew, and I never had the nerve to ask.
Of course.
But I realized this was a non-starter.
Right.
And so we had to figure out a way around that.
Yeah.
So obviously we had photos of her in the show, which we used to great advantage. And there were other actors in the show that were interesting Pat Hingle. Do you remember Pat?
Oh, yeah.
Hingle?
Yeah,
wonderful
actor.
Actor who was not, you know, a marquee name, but certainly right. well respected. So we did a lot of stuff with Pat Hingle, and we worked around it. And there was still plenty of stuff about her, but it wasn't an interview because she obviously
couldn't or wouldn't.
I'm sure all of your projects have their own challenges, but what was the most challenging project that you ever worked on?
Probably both in a good way and a bad way, State Fair.
State Fair.
State Fair was the Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote State Fair for film. It's the only musical they ever wrote initially for the films.
Right.
It was everything else was written initially for stage except for Cinderella, which was written for television initially. And State Fair had been a movie made in the 40s, and then it was remade in the 60s with Pat Boone and not as successfully. And it was kind of nobody much cared. It was just this musical that had a lot of good songs in it,
right.
you know, Might as Well Be Spring, and it's great not for singing, and, you know, songs that we all knew, but it wasn't produced. And then in the mid-90s, the North Carolina School for the Arts did a production that was written by Tom Briggs and Louis Mattioli, and they were connected with the Rodgers and Hammerstein Association, and they organization, and they wrote State Fair to be another one of the shows that R&H could license to schools and to, you know, touring productions or whatever. It was never intended for Broadway. It was going to just be another one of the R&H shows.
Sure.
One of the, you know, there's the Big Five, which is like South Pacific and Sound of Music.
Okay.
And then there were some other shows that were not as successful. And the intention was that State Fair would be yet another one of those shows, R&H shows. The theater, and it was very successful at North Carolina School of the Arts. Susan Egan was in it.
Uh-huh.
It was evidently a wonderful production. And the Theater Guild, which had been huge, you know, in the early days, gave Katharine Hepburn her start and Luntz and, you know, all huge, huge deal, had been sort of on its, you know, low down years. And they decided to take this production of State Fair from North Carolina School of the Arts and take it on the road. They'd never seen it. They never saw a video of it. They just decided, because they had produced the original productions of Oklahoma and Carousel. And they had been R&H, you know, producers. So they decided that they were going to produce this tour,
sight unseen. That's
Of State Fair. Okay. So they cast State Fair, and I was involved with this from day one, like Applause. It was one of those shows where I was right there in the beginning. And they cast it with people that you sort of knew and loved, or more than sort of knew and loved, like John Davidson, who was adorable, and people knew him from all his television shows and his movies, and he's a huge what's called a TVQ, which is a likability on television.
Totally,
and
gonna sell tickets.
And began in the theater. He played Bert Lahr's son on Broadway. Is his first job.
Huh.
And John Davidson, by the way, is God's gift to the press agent. He's just the best. I love John Davidson. Okay. So John Davidson was cast as the father. Catherine Crosby, who was Bing Crosby's widow, was cast as the mother.
Oh, wow.
Andrea McCardle, who was the original Annie, was cast as the daughter. Scott Wise, who was the best
Interviewed for this podcast.
I love Scotty. I take tap class from Scotty.
Oh, my God.
I love Scott Wise. He has a wonderful school in New Milford.
That's right.
I take tap class there.
Cool.
I know. I love him. Scotty was the sort of, I don't know what you call it, but he was adorable.
The love interest.
Ben Wright, who had been in
Into the Woods.
Into the Woods,
oh,
thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Was the other young male lead. Donna McKechnie, of course, from Chorus Line.
It was a cast.
Was the sort of older woman that Ben falls in love with in the show. So everything about it, these were people that you knew and loved, that you cared about, that you if you were in the theater, that you certainly knew about.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. And I used to have this thing that I used to say to people, but it was true. The overture would begin, and we would, 5 minutes, we would look around the audience, and everybody would be sitting in the audience with a big dopey grin on their face. Because, first of all, you knew all the songs. It's a grand night for singing. You knew all those songs. And then John Davidson would come out, and you go, "Oh, John Davidson." And then Catherine Crosby, "Oh, Andrew McCulloch." You wanted to love it, yeah. And you did. And so you sat there with this big sappy grin on your face through the whole show. It was like I used to say, it's comfort food in the theater.
Yeah, it's just a show about a state fair in Iowa. Like, it's just sweet.
It's just fun.
Yeah.
And people loved it. And everybody said, we give it the blue ribbon. That was the big thing. Every critic, every review, of course, the kind of. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I remember that in the logo. And
but it wasn't that wasn't the original logo. It became the logo eventually when we came to New York. But it was another logo from North Carolina School of the Arts. They bought that along with the show. So state fair was never supposed to come to New York. It was never intended to come to Broadway. It was going to be a 9-month tour, and that was it.
Yeah.
That was it. Along comes David Merrick.
Ugh.
Thank you.
The abominable showman,
had by this, who of course was the greatest Broadway producer, all the musicals I grew up on,
right.
You know,
yeah.
Seeing.
Yeah.
David Merrick by this time had a stroke.
Right.
And could neither walk nor talk. So he was in a wheelchair and he couldn't speak. David Merrick and his companion, who subsequently became his wife, wanted to buy the show lock, stock, and barrel from the Theater Guild. The Theater Guild, after much discussion, said no. Because everybody said, you're getting into bed with the devil. And they were right. And so the Theater Guild said, no, we won't sell you the production, but you can become our partners. And so, maybe not the best decision, it became David Merrick presents the Theater Guild production of Rodgers and Hammerstein State Fair.
Wow.
There's a lot to put on a marquee.
Yeah.
So then we had David Merrick, who really, really, really wanted to be back on Broadway and wanted people to, you know.
Sure. Right.
Acknowledge
his... See his name above the lights.
Exactly.
Again. Yeah.
And so it went from this nice little touring show, which was like comfort food for theatergoers, to coming to Broadway.
Broadway,
yeah. Showbiz. And yeah. it was never intended to come to Broadway. And so all of a sudden, slam bam, we're getting ready for Broadway. Suddenly we have a theater and we have a date and we have we're going to Broadway, you know. And part of us we're hysterical with joy because we all love the show so much and we're so happy about it. And the other part of it is like, should we really be going to Broadway with this show? Because this maybe isn't Broadway.
Yeah.
It was done in a very old-fashioned way. It mm-hmm. was all... Do you know what push sticks are? Moving
yes.
scenery? It's
yeah.
the old-fashioned way of pushing it out with a stick.
Totally.
As opposed to it having tracks on the stage floor. I mean, there were tracks, but they weren't electrified. So so literally push sticks. So you'd be standing in the stage and there'd be a wagon with a set piece on it. And guys would go...
It's very old-fashioned.
I'm showing with my hands on the radio.
I'm pushing.
And that's how the sets moved.
Wow.
It had painted backdrops, which was very old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. You know, it had a painted show curtain.
Right.
Very old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. You know, it was...
Just the fact it had an overture. I mean...
Had an overture.
Oh,
yeah. And it was... But it was done beautifully because it was Rodgers and Hammerstein, and God knows... You know, you want a waltz, let's get one from them. You know, let's get a Richard Rodgers waltz. And it was beautifully done. And the people were wonderful. And, of course, they'd been touring for 9 months, so they were great. And so suddenly we were coming to New York with a new logo with the big blue ribbon and money, you know, or so we thought. And it was something, you know. But it wasn't supposed to happen that way. Nobody was more surprised than the Rodgers and Hammerstein Association because they didn't think it was going to come to Broadway. And in fact, they had to get their permission because they weren't entirely convinced it should. Now, it did come to Broadway and it got mostly very good reviews. The sad thing, well, not sad, but the interesting thing was that it opened during the same season as Rent.
Yes.
And so here we had, on one hand, we had this, you know, hip, cutting-edge show that everybody was lining up outside to see. And on the other hand, we had this very old-fashioned, warm and fuzzy, mm-hmm. you know...
Traditional,
like, very old-fashioned, but very endearing show. And I always, you know, this is the eternal question, if it had opened in another season, would it have been different?
Of course.
And maybe yes, maybe no. You never know.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting because the contrast between the two shows was so extreme You know, it wasn't as if they opened against, you know, a sort of traditional other kinds of shows, which were around. But here was Rent, which was, you know, the cutting
edge.
The
Hamilton of its day, really.
Yeah. Exactly. I was thinking that.
Yeah.
And this very kind of throwback, old-fashioned show for which there was an audience.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting, and it was because David Merrick really wasn't David Merrick anymore, and his spokesperson, his companion, we would have a meeting, and David Merrick would say we'd ask him a question, and he was in there sometimes, but he couldn't speak, and so you would ask him a question, and he would sort of mumble, and then she would say, "Well, Mr. Merrick feels," and she would talk for 20 minutes, and you'd think, "Wow, she got all that from," you know, and it was very hard to keep a straight face because she would say, "Well, Mr. Merrick feels," and she would just go on and on and on and on and on, and you would have to listen because you know, she was, as we used to say,
producer, yeah,
she was standing on David Merrick's money. And so it was a very peculiar thing because she didn't know anything. I mean, she wasn't...
Right. She spent her whole life in the theater.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if he said something, you would listen because he was David Merrick.
He did it.
And
yeah.
he knew, you
yeah.
know. But she really didn't.
Wow.
And so it was very peculiar. And eventually... it kind of turned into a mess, and well, you know, and then
how
closed.
Could it not?
But yeah. But before it became a mess, she decided to fire everybody, and including the press agent.
Isn't she amazing? All right, join us again next week for part two of our interview with Susan Shulman, where she is going to tell us about an incident with Zero Mostel, what it was like publicizing the first reality show, and how she got an FBI file. Yes, she has an FBI file. For all that and more, tune in next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.